Hello, my name is Holly Lewis.
My name is Lawson Keeney.
And I am Jean Lewis.
And welcome to The Long Watch, the internet's premier pro-John Lithgow podcast, where we stick to the list for better or worse. This week we have dipped back into horror, a less self-referential one this time around, back to something a little more micro-budget.
See, although I don't know if I'd call it horror. I don't know if it is. It's
I would odd. Say horror.
Thriller, horror.
Yeah.
It has explicitly supernatural
and
elements.
Not only does it have...
This is where I push back against you as well. I would not call it a supernatural thing because that implies ghosts or ghouls or something. I would say this is more of like a Twilight Zone-y science fiction.
Yeah.
That this is a breaching of space and time, not the work of any demon.
Okay, but like a lot of people would still cite the Twilight Zone as being supernatural also, beyond natural.
It depends on the episode.
But either way, we watched The Caller from 2011, and this not only has one person who played a vampire, like Lawson said at the end of last episode, but it also has a Rachel Lefebvre, I believe that's how you say her name.
No, Rachel Lefebvre.
Rachel Lefebvre, who played Victoria in the first two Twilight films.
I thought it was the way you pronounced it as well, until I thought that for like a decade, ever since she turned up on Lost, until I finally saw someone say her name in a behind-the-scenes featurette for this movie.
Yeah, and I believe that the shitty ex-husband is also from True Blood, I believe.
Well, why don't you check?
I did
all right,
check.
Let's start the passive-aggressiveness.
But I'm not sure if he played a vampire there.
Starting the passive-aggressiveness
right.
early
so,
today.
Before we get into that, we'll talk about what we've seen within the week. Kind of a sparse week for all of us. Lawson, why don't you start us off?
Just two movies for me this week. First off, following off on last week's deep dive, which meant I had to watch its direct-to-video sequel, although I strongly contest it being called a sequel. It is Fright Night 2 New Blood. It is a vampire film directed by Eduardo Rodriguez, and this is just a remake of Fright Night in all but name. It does not act as if the events of the previous movie have happened. Evil Ed is alive. None of them know that vampires exist. That the Peter Vincent is a completely different person doing a completely different thing and has never met them before. But it is basically a remake and not a good one either. It's about some American high school students who are doing a sort of foreign exchange university course thing. It's not quite clear, in Romania, which is where this movie was shot. Charlie, played this time by Will Payne, is one of them, and he's there with his best friend Evil Ed, played by Chris Waller, but he's also on the outs with his girlfriend Amy, played by Sasha Parkinson, who is there as well. Amy believes that he has cheated on her under circumstances that the movie never really makes clear. And while they're there, they begin to realize that their arts professor, Jerry Dandridge, played by Jamie Murray, because this is Jerry with a G E-R-I, not Jerry with a J, so it is actually a woman. But Jerry Dandridge is a vampire, and so they go to the host of a haunted house web series, Peter Vincent, played by Sean Power, for help. I would bet money that this started out as a spec script for something completely different. I don't think that this became Fright Night until someone at Sony just decided, hey, we can just chuck the name on here. And, you know, Jerry down in accounting told us that that would increase sales by 20%. You know, I'm almost certain that that's what happened here, because the broader strokes are similar, but otherwise it bears so little relation. The fine detail really is not Fright Night. It just isn't. It's a completely different vibe. It's a completely different sort of tone. It kind of reminded me of, you know, any number of weird sort of European thrillers that I've seen in the past. Charlie and Amy are far less interesting as characters. This whole did he cheat on her or not thing is A, never resolved, and B, is in the end a non-factor. It doesn't tell us anything about either of them, and it has no bearing on the plot, so you sort of wonder why they even chose to go this direction in the first place. And what can I say about the presentation of Peter Vincent in this? other than it is a complete character assassination. It is just this bro who hangs out in strip clubs getting drunk. And, you know, his most memorable line in the movie is, "Welcome to Fright Night for real, bitch." So, you know, really, what are we doing here, people? Why are we calling this Fright Night? Why are we calling these characters by these names? And the version of Evil Ed they've got here is just so annoying. I mean, no one covers themselves in glory in this movie, but Waller is just giving a bad performance. The most interesting stuff at the end of the day is Murray as Jerry, because the gender swap does create some interesting dynamics, even if it is also a really obvious vehicle for, you know, not even subtextual sort of sapphic activity between Jerry and a number of random women that she picks up, clearly aimed at a male viewership. There's an attempt to tie in the character of Jerry to the mythology of Elizabeth Bathory, who was a noble way, way, way back, who is believed to have killed like huge numbers of peasant girls and bathed in their blood under the assumption that that kept her young. And so there's a, obviously, you know, as the movie progresses, I don't think this is a spoiler, you discover that Jerry is Elizabeth Bathory, still alive as a vampire after all this time. That's kind of interesting. That's, you know, the character, the iconography of Elizabeth Bathory as a sort of demon of history is always interesting, but I don't think they do much with it. I'm tempted, as I was last week, to draw a less than progressive reading of the movie and its subtext, this time about, you know, the evil lesbian vampire that has to be conquered by the young man so that he can reclaim his girlfriend and reinforce a heteronormative view of the world. You know, I think it's iffy, but I also don't think that the movie is smart enough to have thought any of that through. So I suppose it cancels it all out in the end. The Romanian setting works. I mean, the whole set of castles and old world architecture that they've got over there gives them, you know, terrific value for money. And it definitely fits in this sort of vampire setting, all of these old, you know, alleyways and buildings and things. I mean, it fits the vibe. But really, at the end of the day, this is a film that only exists to capitalize on a brand that it's not really a part of. And so I just can't recommend it, full stop.
How many years after the remake was this?
Two. So
Jesus Christ, guys.
Yeah, 2013. Because the remake did not do that well. Like, I think it's fairly well remembered, or it's remembered as one of the better of the horror remakes of that time. But it didn't exactly light the box office on fire. I just pull it up here. Yeah, it only made $41 million on a $30 million budget, so it was never going to get much care thrown at a sequel. But yeah, the other movie I've got to talk about this week is another horror movie, this time a fantasy horror movie called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, directed by Troy Nixie. It is based on the 1973 television movie of the same name, directed by John Newland, and it follows an anxious kid named Sally, played by Bailey Madison. Her mother is just tired of her. She's an anxious kid. She's kind of neurotic, and so her mother just doesn't want to give her the time of day anymore, so she sends her off to stay with her well-meaning but emotionally distant father, Alex, played by Guy Pearce, and his new girlfriend, Kim, played by Katie Holmes, because they're off renovating big houses and then reselling them at a profit. And they're currently in the middle of going through this massive gothic estate. And when Sally gets there, they uncover this hidden cellar that has been sealed away. And when they enter into it, they discover, or rather Sally does, no one believes her at first, that there are evil fairies that live in the cellar, and they would very much like to eat Sally's teeth.
Ooh, cool.
They are tooth fairies. So this is produced by Guillermo del Toro. It is a project that he worked to get off the ground for a very long time. The TV movie is one that he cites as being very influential on him when he saw it as a child. And you know, you can see the Del Toro influence. It's more commercial than Pan's Labyrinth, but it's got a very similar sort of fairy tale vibe, dark fairy tale vibe.
Yeah, fairies stealing people's teeth. That sounds like a Del Toro.
Well, yeah, it does have a classicism to it that you see in a lot of Del Toro's works, a respect for literary heritage. You know, that whole child finds supernatural secret, you know, child finds almost a portal into a world of secret supernatural or mystical, magical stuff, except, you know, obviously it being a Del Toro joint, the magical secret stuff turns out to be actually kind of horrific. It is R-rated. I mean, these fairies really want teeth, so
They're gonna go get them.
it's got an American R rating that, like, and to a degree that, you know, is effective sometimes, but by the end of the movie, when they've given up on subtlety anymore and they're just showing the fairies running around with blades slicing people's ankles, it gets a little bit sort of, it stops being quite so atmospheric and becomes like a off-brand version of the Spiderwick Chronicles. But it has a great use of this big gothic production design. I mean, the design of the house, the lighting, it's very spooky and classic. I'd say it's atmospheric more than scary, but I will also say that I am far more susceptible than most to horrifying situations regarding teeth at the moment than most people are, because as you would both know, I am undergoing fairly intensive dentistry next month. I won't go into it here, but it is of the kind that whenever I tell people what it entails, they wince and cover their mouths. So,
Oh yeah, I'm pretty sensitive around that region too.
Oh yeah, the way you described it was like something out of fucking Hellraiser.
It's not a good scene. I'm not looking forward to it. But the movie in the end ends up being kind of really about childhood and about, you know, connecting with your parents when there's distance in that relationship. I mean, here is this girl who is cast away by her mother and now is in this new house with a father who won't listen to her. And, you know, it does some interesting stuff with the character of Katie Holmes as well, in that it ends up subverting the evil stepmother thing, that here is this girlfriend who the daughter is initially quite suspicious of, who ends up becoming her greatest advocate and her greatest protector against the tooth fairies. Like I said, the third act shows the creatures too much. I mean, it's a good design, but it loses the creepiness of them sort of operating in shadow behind the scenes.
A sort of a diminishing return sort of thing.
I mean, you're just seeing it too much. I mean, it's like when Jaws is scary right up until the big rubber shark jumps out of the ocean and you see it really well. But the ending is missing some unifying thread, some way to tie together all of the themes and the plot lines in a way that hits emotionally as well as just from a clean narrative perspective. It becomes a little generic. It does keep its teeth, haha, but it becomes a little generic. It has a great child performance by Bailey Madison, though. Pierce and Holmes are very good, and this was filmed in Australia. Australia subbing in for America, so you get Jack Thompson as a supporting character, and you also get a surprise Neighbours reunion between Guy Pearce and Alan Dale,
Hey.
who is in the film briefly. But yeah, it's a good one. I think that you guys would like it. Have you ever seen it?
No.
No, but we'll have to check it out.
I like twists on fairy tales. It's why I'm such a big Del Toro fan, because fairies, back in the way that the stories were told in the olden days, they stole children. They were nasty little creatures when they wanted to be. And
They were supposed to be scary.
I love seeing it get back to that. And a nasty tooth fairy taking teeth instead of just waiting. That's very fun. That shows initiative.
Yep, so that's everything you've got.
Yep, that's me done.
So, we've got a couple of shows that are coming back up. Obviously, The Boys will be coming back. It's, well, no, not The Boys. Yeah, scratch that.
Gen V, the spin-off, is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, we haven't started that just yet, but we're doing that soon. But we have picked up back another show that we were watching. Sex Education has reached its fourth and final season. Not going to get into much of it because a lot of that is spoiler-based stuff where we ended off last season. But yeah, it's good old sex education. There's more complications. Everyone's doing a really good job as performers. Just really strong stuff. And I'm just glad they got a chance to end it.
Yeah.
You know? We haven't finished the final episode yet, but it's an ending, you know? And that's lucky because it's Netflix. And you never know if you're going to be given that chance to actually end it or it's going to get shit canned.
They're generally, like, the danger zone is seasons 1 and 2. Once you get to season 3 on, they seem to give you a little more respect.
But,
which is,
you know,
a really sad way of putting it, if you think about it.
It's just good to get an ending to something. But, yeah, we haven't really watched all that much television this week, at least movies. But we did go to a live sort of performance-based thing. Well, no, it was a... How would you explain it, John?
So,
kind of like
for the
50-year concert?
So, for the 50-year anniversary of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, a film or an experience has been created for 100 different planetariums across the world where they would do a screening of this new video for Dark Side of the Moon, the whole album. So we took a trip to the Sir Thomas Brisbane Planetarium, and that's in Mount Coosa, and we experienced the Dark Side of the Moon. And what's so cool about this was it's the new 5.1 audio mix, and it's a new video package put together being led by Aubrey Powell, who was one of the members of Hypnosis, very famous album art company, very famous photography and art company just in general. And this has sort of been led a lot by him as tribute for the 50th anniversary. Because back when Dark Side of the Moon originally came out, there was a listening party for people from the industry at a planetarium. None of the members of Pink Floyd showed up, but this was sort of meant to be a quote-unquote recreation or tribute to that. So basically, when you're sitting in the planetarium, they've got all this a curved screen, like a dome screen.
You know, it's a planetarium.
Projected upon. And it was an amazing experience because the way that the curved screen is, you're looking up and you're watching it, and it adds so much depth to the image.
You know, when you're at a planetarium, they have that curved roof and projections get put on it, like constellations and whatnot. They have a bunch of different shows that they put on. They had this sort of really detailed, very intricate, sort of animated film almost that went alongside the album. And the speakers in this location were really, really good. And it had this surround sound effect to it. It was just really, really great experience there at the planetarium. We also got to see a bunch of the, you know, little things that they've got there at the planetarium before we started it.
The educational exhibits that they've got. There were bits of meteors that they have on loan. Can I speak, Holly? They've got little bits of meteors that they've got on loan from the museum in Brisbane. They've got all of these little displays about how Australian First Nations people would look at the stars and use that as a way to know where they were traveling to, and they would tell stories not only with the constellations but the spaces between them, which is all very interesting.
We also got a really cool opportunity before the show started to go up into the actual area with the telescope,
the observatory, and
look through it and see Saturn, which appeared very frequently in the show itself.
Which is interesting because it appeared during the song Time, and Saturn is the Roman name for the Titan Kronos. And if you know your etymology, Kronos, Chronosphere, Chronomancy, Chronology. Kronos was the
Titan of time.
For time. So I found that to be really interesting, and that sort of all tied together. But I do thoroughly suggest going to the Sir Thomas Brisbane Planetarium in Mount Coosa. It's a very lovely space. It's a very lovely complex, I would call it, because there are nature walks that you can go on. There's a whole thing there. You could spend a day there.
So they have a bunch of other little shows that they put on. A lot of them are educational for the children. But they're going to have this particular experience on through March next year. It's only about $16 for like a 42-minute experience, but I would highly recommend it. I'm a big fan of the album. It's probably, yeah, I'd still have to say my second favorite Pink Floyd album. I only really know two of them to any deep degree, but it was a great experience. I had a really good time. And I'm looking forward to any more of those types of shows that they bring to the planetarium, because I'd really like to go there again.
It's just a lovely space, and there's a lovely energy, and the people who work there are very nice. So I wouldn't be against going back there for one of their other programs.
Yeah, you can even buy a little plush tardigrade.
Yeah.
Little water bears. I love those little guys. But
have you ever been?
No. Wilson?
It's a lovely place.
I think you'd like it there. Even though none of us are big fans of space, it's still really cool. So that is what we've seen within the week. Now we'll play for
you
the trailer.
I have a piss take as well.
Oh, yeah, you've got a piss take, sorry.
So I have been to the theatre, and I have seen a new stage musical that premiered in Brisbane recently as part of the Brisbane Festival. It's a musical comedy called Banana Land, and it is written by Keir Nuttall, with music by both himself and his wife, Kate Miller-Heidke. It follows an extremely unsuccessful punk rock band called Kitty Litter, who are comprised mainly of, you know, these Gen Z young people who do all these protest songs and things. Ruby, played by Max McKenna, her sister Karen, played by Georgina Hobson, her boyfriend Seb, played by Joe Kalu, and the overenthusiastic X, played by Maxwell Simon, as well as Terry and Terry, who are the backing for the band, and basically it's a good gag to get some on stage instrumentation. It's X and X, and it's just these stone faced guys. Terry and Terry are just these stone faced guys in their black with dark sunglasses who never say anything, but are frequently referred to by the other characters. Anyways, they are incredibly unsuccessful. It's sort of impotent Gen Z rage against the state of the world. But then their protest song, Banana Land, is misinterpreted by the internet as a children's song and becomes a huge hit, and they hate it. So
what's the actual message behind the song Banana Land? Is that about, like...
I'm not going to say, because that's actually an incredible punchline when they actually finally say what it is that the song is about. But I'll tell you off air. Actually, I'll just text you with a direct quote. It got a good reaction from the crowd. But this is fantastic. It's hilarious and clever. It's first and foremost a satire of the music industry, definitely, but of also of youth protests and the real issues at play that, you know, young people are upset about and concerned about. It doesn't get myopic about it. It doesn't get clear. It is clear-eyed. It doesn't get, you know, lost in the woods. It doesn't stop. It doesn't make fun of young people for being upset at the state of the world. But equally, it doesn't, you know, green light every form of, you know, completely ineffectual protest that's never going to have any impact on the real world as being, you know, capital I important either. It has fun with the idea, but most importantly, it has empathy. It has empathy for its characters, and it has empathy for, you know, the future and for people who are really unsure about the future at this present point in history. It has a very heavy dose of absurdist comedy to it as well. I mean, I mentioned the Terry and Terry bit, but once they reluctantly become a children's band, one of them is designated to be the one that wears the animal suit, you know, the Dorothy the dinosaur, but it's like this dog, and he puts the suit on, but, you know, the suit starts wearing him, so he starts behaving more and more dog-like, which,
you can't let yourself get caught in that downward spiral of being a mascot.
Yeah.
You always have to find you and not get lost.
It has some great one-liners. It's a very, very funny show, and it really connected with the audience. There was just a lot of laughter. An exceptional cast as well, from really beginning to end. McKenna and Simon are really strong, as the two strongest members of the core cast. But then you've got Dave Eastgate, who plays this kind of, like, you know, Yobbo Sky News watching guy who sort of kind of against all reason ends up joining the group as like this Bob the Builder style guest performer. and also Amber McMahon, who plays a series of characters sort of filling out the background female performers who come on with, you know, one or two scenes. It's always Amber McMahon in a different get up with a different voice, and she's very good. The music is strong. The singing is exceptional. And it does a really good job of blending kind of traditional pop ballads with punk and with kids music as well. You can definitely hear the Kate Miller high key in it. But it really, you know, it was a great, great time. And it had the audience on their feet by the end of the show. I mean, it really, really struck a chord. And it was packed. So I wouldn't be surprised if this was a thing that kept coming round. But if you guys get the chance to see it, I think it's already left QPAC. But if you guys get the chance to see it, I really strongly recommend it because I think you guys would love it.
Yep. So anyone have anything else?
Nope.
Yep.
Nope. No worries. Now we will play for you the trailer to The Caller.
No, I just moved in.
You may have mistakenly wandered into mechanical engineer as opposed to...
conversational French. Hope you won't be too offended.
A little disappointed, maybe.
Hello,
I told
you. Mary.
There's been a mistake. This friend of yours, he really isn't here.
I saw him right there in the window. What did I ever do to you? What's the date?
This is harassment.
September 4th, 1979. I can prove it. You know that big kitchen pantry? I'll draw something. And then if it's still there, you'll know I'm right.
George, can I ask you something? Who lived in my apartment?
Rose Lazar.
I can't believe I'm telling you this.
You're talking to a Trekkie. I can handle it. This is time like a river. And this is something that happens, an event.
What happened to her?
Killed herself.
What if something interferes with that and makes a new friend, say? You erase it, and you draw another one. We get a whole different path.
You were supposed to kill yourself, you know that? George found you.
I got rid of him, Mary.
You killed him.
George!
Where's George?
Excuse me?
This is his apartment.
No.
You remember George.
I never met him, Mary.
You think I'm crazy?
I'm going to bury something. Dig it up.
Ah! Hello?
Who's this?
Mary!
Recognize the voice. It's yours.
You never should have lied.
Who's this?
Name's John.
John Queen. Mary's little friend.
That was the trailer for The Caller. It is based on the short film Rose, which was an episode of the 1998 British anthology TV series Two Lives, whose writer returns with the screenplay of the film. Set in Puerto Rico, the film follows Mary Key, played by Rochelle Lefevre, who is moving into a small apartment building as she works through an extremely unamicable divorce with her abusive husband, Stephen, played by Ed Quinn. Stephen's a real piece of shit, stalking and harassing her in a deranged attempt to get her to go back to him. Mary's having none of it. She's ready to move on and has even enrolled in night classes at a local university, where she forges a connection with John Guidi, played by Stephen Moyer, an engineering teacher whose class she accidentally walks into whilst searching for a French lesson. Things are difficult, but they're getting better. That is, until Mary answers a call on the old-school rotary phone that has come with her dingy apartment. The woman on the other end of the line is Rose Lazar, played by Lorna Raver, and she demands to speak to a man she is sure lives in Mary's apartment. Mary tries to convince her she's barking up the wrong tree, but when Rose starts insisting that the year is 1979, Mary has had enough. It's Rose who wonders if they might somehow be communicating through time, and after an experiment scrawling a rose on the wall back in the 70s that Mary then finds beneath the wallpaper in the present day, both women are well and truly convinced. A conversation with her neighbour, long-time building resident George, played by Luis Guzman, reveals Rose's history to Mary. A withdrawn and unhappy woman, she died by suicide years earlier. Driven by pity, Mary continues to chat with Rose over the phone, commiserating with her on their relationships with abusive men. Overwhelmed by the divorce, Mary wonders aloud if it might just have been better to kill Stephen. And the next morning, she wakes up to a new wall in her kitchen. A small space in her pantry has been bricked off, and when Mary receives a triumphant call from Rose, who excitedly reveals that she killed her boyfriend and hid his body behind the wall, she comes to the sickening realization that the woman she's talking to is extremely unstable. Mary tries to cut off all contact, but Rose refuses to be ignored, taking violent actions in the past that begin to upend Mary's life in the future. Desperate, and with a pantry increasingly packed with desiccated corpses, Mary turns to John for help, but Rose isn't about to let her new friend get away. Rose coldly explains that if she has to, she'll track Mary down in 1979 to ensure her cooperation in the present, and the new scars appearing on Mary's body leave no room for doubt that she's 100% serious. So, before we get too deep into this, why don't we each go around and give our timed 30-second thoughts on The Caller. Why don't you start us off, Johnny? You ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I thought this was quite interesting because it does play with those two different times, and it has a lot of fun trying to bridge those gaps. And a lot of what the movie is doing is getting you suspicious of everyone. And that's very important for the themes here of she's already in a very tenuous state. She's in a very bad situation. And all of this that's happening around her is just making it much, much worse.
All right. Ready, Harley?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
Would you be surprised that this movie is about abuse and paranoia and trauma? And the movie really plays with that kind of energy. You end up very paranoid that you can't trust anyone, because for a good portion of the movie you think that it might be someone gaslighting her, and the cinematography really, really helps with that. It's got kind of this, what's the word, voyeuristic vibe?
It's interesting that you guys found it so difficult to take the premise at face value, that you thought something else was up, because I never did. I never thought that anyone was gaslighting her. I just thought that there was a crazy lady on the phone from 1979. And I think that, you know, it works on both levels, it sounds like, because I really enjoyed this movie too. I interpreted it as a very Twilight Zone-esque sort of Rod Serling piece about, you know, the experience of women both in the past and in the present, and how not a lot has actually changed, but obviously then given a big thriller twist to it.
Well, I suppose the difference between us is you've seen the trailer.
Not when I've seen the movie, I hadn't.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, this is the... I might have. Look, this is the thing. I made this list, 6 years ago now? Mm. A lot of these, especially these smaller ones, I have no clue what they are. Like, I've completely forgotten what caused me to put them on the list in the first place. I mean, obviously, there are your big ones, or there are the ones that have become cult hits. I mean, I haven't seen The Witch, but when I go to see The Witch, I have a vague understanding.
You know what The Witch is.
I know what The Witch is. I still remember it. But then there's a bunch of other stuff from 2016 that I made the call on years ago, and, you know, I couldn't put a gun to my head. I couldn't tell you what they were about.
Yeah.
I think the thing that made us think that there was some gaslighting going on is because the entire film starts with this feeling of paranoia and a lot of watching things from a distance, watching people from a distance, and the coldness of the color grade and the way that all of the buildings at the beginning of the movie loom and impose and create a claustrophobic feeling created that sense of people being watched and there being some kind of danger there. And that was just solidified by, you know, the abusive ex-husband.
The thing that I caught on to is a little bit of symbology they do right at the start. So Luis Guzman has helped her into an apartment, and they talked a little bit about the stick insects that she's got in her sort of little terrarium. And she says, oh, don't worry about it, it's friendly. Then as he's leaving, he asks, how do you know it's being friendly?
Yeah, what could a stick insect do to indicate to a human whether it is being friendly or otherwise?
Yeah, and the moment he said that, it's like,
it was an incredibly pointed question.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just got stuck in my head that you can read a lot of the behaviors from a lot of the characters here, particularly the men, in multiple different ways. This is a lot like Barbarian in that regard, particularly the stuff with Skarsgård. There's a lot of the behaviors that can track as nice, or if you looked at it just a different way, it becomes dodgy. Like, there's a lot of that sort of, especially when you only see these people a couple of times near the beginning, that you're just like, I don't know. I don't know about their vibe. You know what I mean?
Okay, then how would you then explain away the thing with the wallpaper? Like, okay, this is a better question, I suppose. At what point do you stop thinking that it's gaslighting, or that it could be?
Well, she's clearly an incredibly heavy sleeper. Old mate breaks into the house and strokes her frickin' head.
I think...
Like, I wouldn't be surprised if anything went... Like, a concert could go on and she'd still be asleep.
But surely by the time
I
that
think
there's,
I thought
a
it was
new,
both.
There's a new wall in her pantry.
Yeah, obviously by that point I'm like, obviously there's something dodgy and not quite realistic going on here. But that paranoia is incredibly important. And the fact that you don't know who you can trust until they're gone.
Yeah.
The character George, I trusted him like the whole time. He seemed like he was on the level. I liked him.
I felt like there was a mix of both. That there was a kind of wibbly wobbly kind of sci-fi ghost thing happening, but I also thought that there was something also happening in the background with some of the men in the movie, because horror films have given me trust issues. And the entire time, the way that men are framed, the way that they're shot, the way that their first interactions with... What's the main character's name?
Mary.
The way that their first interactions with Mary are sort of colored gave me this sense of I couldn't really trust anyone.
Well, part of that is being in Mary's shoes.
Yeah.
At the start of the film. She's recently gotten out of this incredibly abusive relationship. She is living alone for the first time in quite a long time in a dingy-ass apartment, getting what she thinks are crank calls from this creepy lady talking about, you know, people who were living in that apartment. You're supposed to feel uneasy. You're supposed to feel afraid. And it only becomes more and more... The paranoia grows deeper and deeper the more the movie goes on. You start to realize that this stuff with Rose on the phone is real.
Did you recognize the voice, by the way? Lorna Raver?
I went onto the IMDb. Thankfully, it didn't tell me shit about what was going on. But I heard the voice, and when she said, I'm 41, I'm like, bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. They try and say in the behind-the-scenes material that the director was like, really concerned about hiring her because she was, you know, much older than the character was supposed to be. But then when he actually talked to her on the phone, she didn't sound old at all. And then he brought it up to her and she switched back into a regular talking voice. And he was like, oh, she's been doing a young voice on the phone the whole time. I know, she sounded...
I don't buy it. She yeah. sounded yeah.
But like,
old from
it
the
was,
get-go. But I was like,
it wasn't,
God.
For me, it wasn't that she sounded old all the time. It was on
certain words
where, like,
I was like,
it's the certain stresses, the vocal fry on certain words that makes you go, hang on a tick.
Yeah, I thought to myself, I know that voice from somewhere. And then I looked it up, it's Mrs. Ganoush from Drag Me to Hell. Hell yeah.
Crazy lady. That vocal performance is outstanding.
Yeah.
I have to say. Like, you get the thread of her, like, by the end you see her, but the thread of her is carried entirely by her voice.
I mean, she, Lorna Raver is used to communicating and doing performances via voice. She's actually a fairly, well, not so much anymore, I don't think, but was during her heyday, a fairly prolific audiobook narrator.
Mm.
So she actually narrated the audiobook of both Cujo and The Art of War.
Oh, sick.
But, like, she is incredibly good here. Mm. She carries the threat not only by the moments when she sounds angry, but the moments when she sounds sweet, too. Like, right at the start.
Mm.
And...
Well, she just sounds tired. She sounds like she's... You know, yeah. She's not been treated right by this... What's his name? Brian?
Bob?
I don't know.
Bob?
Bobby?
Bobby, yeah, I think Bobby. That's it.
Some piece of shit.
But, like, she just sounds... Like, you get why Mary stays on the phone with her in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you talked a little bit about the symbology of the stick insect, Harley, but I think there's also some symbology there of the phone itself, that the phone... Mm. Especially the sort of it being an older sort of rotary style phone, does draw to mind, you know, traditional gender roles in the home, especially in the time that Rose is still living in. That, you know, the phone was in a very real sense the, you know, the channel,
the main
out.
Method of communication.
Yeah, the main method of communication, the method of for a woman of communicating outside of the house in those traditional gender roles. So I think that it's thought through, it's well chosen. It's not in the movie, but there was a deleted scene that shows that this only even really happens because Mary accidentally breaks her own modern phone while unpacking in the move into the house. And there's also an alternate ending, which is not really an alternate ending. It's literally a deleted scene. They just cut the last scene from the script and ended it where they ended it. But there was going to be one more scene after the scene that you see in the theatrical cut that was a completely different apartment and new couple moving in, and then the phone starts ringing and the woman goes to pick it up. And it was like, whoa, Mamma Mia, here we go again, you know, and you don't need it. But I suppose you could have argued, if that ending remained, that this was a continuation of what I said in my brief thoughts was my reading of the theme, which was the state of society and how it treats women, you know, all of these women connected by the same circumstances that they're forced to navigate over space and time.
Yeah.
And the idea that, like, trauma is obviously a really big deal in the movie.
Mm.
Abuse is a huge deal because Rose becomes abusive to Mary, not just over the phone, but physically. Because this is also a secret time travel movie. Or at least, it's complicated.
Can you say time travel if the person isn't actually traveling, it's just their voice?
Information is traveling through time, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose.
So you could, it's still a time travel movie.
It's a technicality, but I'll allow it. It's
it's a time travel movie because they have a scene where a guy writes on a piece of paper shit about timelines and how things diverge.
Yeah.
That is how you know it's a time travel movie, Lawson. If there's a diagram or metaphor used to explain how time works.
And that's where the threat comes from, that she's talking to this woman in the past. So, you know, you might think, well, there's no way for her to get to Mary in the present day. But no, she can get to Mary in the past, and she can take action in the past that has a pretty profound effect on Mary's safety and happiness in the present day. And, you know, that's some of the most brutal stuff, is when she finally does knock down that wall, and it's not just old, you know, Bobby or whoever, but it's the bodies of Louise Guzman and Stephen Moyer as well. Stephen Moyer, who she got when he was like a literal child, like a 7 or 8 year old from the sounds.
Wiped out of the timeline.
Yeah, because they were basically opponents of, they were allies of Mary and opponents of Rose in the present day.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting, I mean, we've talked about the relationship between sort of the men of the story and the central characters of Mary and Rose, that literally every male character in the movie, with the exception, I suppose, of Stephen Moyer's father, is killed. None of them make it out alive.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting, as because there is a kind of, I can't quite settle on what the movie thinks of it, especially given the final scene that they give us with, that she's finally Mary has finally decided to kill Stephen and is like just humming in kind of a like not quite right manner as she bricks up the wall again.
Well, you can imagine that after all of that stuff that's happened, that's quite a lot of trauma to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
She reached the end of her line.
I don't know how much. I don't know if I like it though, because it's kind of like, well, the abuse victim, like back in the past, the abuse victim in the character of Rose is driven over the line and becomes abusive herself and becomes unhinged and unstable. And then continues to abuse through her relationship with Mary. And then at the end, Mary becomes unstable as well. I mean, it's one thing to have her kill Stephen. We've all seen enough of Stephen that no one's particularly sad to see him go. But, you know, if they had cut 30 seconds before they did, if they had cut of that very sort of loaded and determined look she gives him before they cut away to her bricking up the wall, I think that's a much more powerful ending than... Now she's crazy too, because she's humming the same song.
You cut there and you don't show her doing an Edgar Allan Poe special to her.
Yeah.
Walling him up in the wall.
Yeah. I've got to say though, like the fact that she's just like, I'm pretty sure that I've got a 30-year-old dead body in my wall right next to my kitchen, but I'm not going to do anything about it. I could not know. No, like
I wouldn't need to know.
I would not be able to sleep in that house, but let alone that it's in my pantry. It's where I keep my food. No,
I wouldn't be able to think.
Yeah,
if I knew that it was sitting there, like I would have to do something.
Like regardless, if a new wall is popping up in my house that I knew wasn't there before, I kind of want to know what's behind it.
Yeah. But like,
just like my immediate curiosity would be like, okay.
I mean, I gotta know.
Something's being hidden from me.
But even at the end, you know, she's just bricking it back up. Now there's four bodies in there, including the body of her really nice neighbor and the body of the man that she fell in love with, and only then he was then murdered as a child and like stored in the wall. Like it's extremely messed up.
And I think that's what's so interesting and cool about this movie, that it gets fucking nasty.
Mm.
That it uses that time transference, that fact that even if she hears that something's happening, she can't really do anything about it because it's happened already.
Yeah.
And it's this thing of when she does talk to people and say when she tries to go find Josh again.
John.
Or when she goes to find John again and goes to John's parents, all they know is that John died as a child or that John disappeared.
They never found him.
That's
in the wall.
Even worse. And it's this, it is adding on top of that idea of women not being believed.
Yeah.
Mm. And it is constantly, constantly doing that. And
it's
so nasty.
It's no coincidence that the character of John goes, because he's the only one that actually kind of, if he doesn't believe her, maybe he doesn't believe her, but he definitely believes something's going on. He's definitely willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. This is
like,
one of
he knows that he knows that she's being harassed not only by Stephen, but by whoever this Rose is as well.
This is one of the things that I like about the presentation of the character of John, is he's not one of those characters who you just end up getting so frustrated with because he just shuts down any suggestion of the supernatural or the sci-fi-ness or whatever. He does go with it. He's the one that suggests the timeline shenanigans on the piece of paper that you were talking about, Harley.
Yeah.
And, you know, he
might not believe it,
he respects
but he knows that there's something wrong.
He respects her enough to follow through with, to understand that whatever is happening it's a very real problem for her. And, you know, telling her she's crazy is not the way to handle it.
No.
And so, of course, he dies. Of course, he has to, because he's not her protector, but her ally, her someone who can actually...
He's a way out.
He's a, yeah. He is someone who can provide a sense of security against the dual abusers in her life. And so, of course, those, like, it's something that abusers do, isn't it? That they try and cut off, they try and make the person they're abusing feel alone, make them feel like they don't have any friends, like they don't have any way out. So,
and that's what her ex-husband does. He tries to, he constantly flouts the restraining order. Mm. He breaks into her home, watches her sleep. He is incredibly controlling. He tries to get the dog on side.
I've got to tell you, I was terrified he was going to kill that dog.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, don't you do it. Don't you do it.
That dog's a very good boy.
Yeah. Specifically that scene where he...
In the park.
Yeah. I thought, is he going to...
He's got his hands on the dog's head.
Yeah.
It's like, ugh. Don't be one of those movies.
That guy skeeved me out.
Please don't be one of the movies
that
where we have someone kill a dog.
From the moment that we see him. It's like, no, this guy's got a bad vibe. This dude sucks.
Like, he does it really well. The actor does a really good job there.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, Stephen Moyer was originally, when he was approached, to play that character. And
because, I could see it.
Yeah, because he's got, especially at the time with True Blood, John doesn't seem like exactly the right casting you'd think of him for, because John is a little more, you know, friendly and open and sort of like more immediately personable, and that wasn't the vibe that he was giving out in his... He wasn't playing abusers and things. I don't scratch that. I don't really know.
He's playing a vampire.
I haven't seen True Blood, so I don't know. There might be something to do with that character that, you know, is problematic, but like he was playing...
I mean, he kills and drinks people.
Yeah, he was... But he... You know what I mean? But he was playing sort of like more brutish characters than the character of John is. And so he... actually said to the director when they had their meeting, look, I'm way more interested in playing this character of John. And the director was interested in that too, because as you guys were both saying, you know, it sort of, it did put you on edge a little bit, not knowing exactly what his deal was, what his vibe was. Although I must admit, as I said, that didn't really affect me because A, I've never seen True Blood, and B, I didn't have my guards raised.
Oh, I've never seen True Blood before, but I've seen pictures of him in True Blood. I've seen clips of him in True Blood. And I'm like, I'm just imagining his face covered in blood. And it's given me a bad feeling.
The woman who plays Mary, she's excellent here.
Yeah, yeah. Was a last-minute replacement, too. She was originally... the character was originally going to be played by Brittany Murphy.
Mm.
So, Brittany Murphy, obviously... you know, passed away tragically young in late 2009. So Rachelle Lefevre stepped in at, you know, very close to the start of filming. And yeah, she's good. I've seen her in a few things. Like I said,
she was criminally underused in Twilight.
Yeah. Well, then replaced by...
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Bryce Dallas Howard, just as things were getting good. Maybe she wasn't in Lost. Who am I thinking of? Oh, no, I know who I'm thinking of who was in Lost. It's another redhead. But yeah, I've seen her in a number of things. I saw her in the first season of Under the Dome before I ditched on that show.
Yeah. Under the Dome was such a weird one.
I lost track of that one.
Because it starts off with, oh, this is interesting. And you've got all of these interesting little characters with their interesting little... things, and you got that one creepy kid who's the son of the police chief, and
the son of the mayor, isn't he?
Yeah, Junior. Well, it was made 5 years too soon, because if it had been made 5 years later, it would have come out on a Netflix or an Amazon or an HBO as a limited series that just adapted the novel and went home. But instead, it was the CBS needed it as primetime programming, 13 episodes a year for multiple years, and of course it.
Because it's based on a Stephen King book, which don't have the best track record with endings, and CBS was refusing to give it one.
And then they just cancelled it on a cliffhanger.
So. you know, it's one of those particular situations. But Lefebvre is fantastic here. The part that really got me was when, in the past, Rose has kidnapped Kid Mary and has started scalding her with boiling water. And you see the already healed burns appearing on Mary's skin as they happen in the past. And that was insane.
Like, and again, it's another one of those cruelties, because it's not like there's anything she can really do about it. That she's being scolded, she's feeling the pain. She's got to be feeling some kind of strange mental thing of, this can't be happening, but holy fuck, it's happening.
Mm.
And all of that, it's just so cruel. And the effects are really, really solid.
It's effective.
It's walking an interesting line because, I mean, so much of, like, the threat comes from stuff that we're not seeing on screen. It comes from it's a threat that's literally 30 years prior. And the thing that gives it its dramatic heft is how it will immediately affect things for our main character in the present day. And, you know, that's an interesting line to walk. And I think that they do it well. Not only that, but, like, the fact that so much of the movie is phone calls, is, you know, her on the phone. And the director, he manages to make them really dynamic and compelling.
Yeah.
They're a huge part of the movie. And, you know, you think if you're just watching phone calls for 40 minutes, 45 minutes, that could get quite old. But the way that he really mixes it up with the shots and keeping things in motion and having her move around while she's talking on the phone, it gives it a verve that it wouldn't otherwise have.
And the way it's edited, there are also, like, these interstitial bits where you see the phone in black and white while it's ringing, and there are all these little creative details that the director's put in that are really, really interesting. John came up with a really, really interesting question when we saw the bit where they were at that fair, where Mary and John were at the fair, and scenes like that have always fascinated me, because obviously, like, it's not a very big dialogue scene, it's really just sort of a montage, and John wondered, are they in character, or are they just hanging out at this fair?
Because I'm always wondering about that when it's a montage of just people with music over it, and they're just having fun, they're just hanging out, they're talking, but we can't hear anything, or they're off in the distance at a fairground or a park or theme park or anything. It's interesting because you are almost seeing the camaraderie between the actors.
I say this because there's almost a guerrilla quality to it.
Yeah.
Where, obviously, they would have had permission to shoot there. They would have been able to cordon off certain areas so they can get the shots that they need. And they were given time that they needed to actually take the shots. But it feels so boots on the ground.
Mm.
Well, a whole great deal of the movie feels boots on the ground, ultimately. It is... What was the budget for this?
Let me check.
I can't imagine it was very high.
I mean, I know it was originally supposed to be set in New York. And Puerto Rico was going to double for New York. But when they actually went to Puerto Rico, they just decided to just make it Puerto Rico, because then you can use the things that make Puerto Rico interesting as a place. Wikipedia doesn't have a budget listed. What else? Like, this is anything on IMDb? No budget listed, but it made $229,746 worldwide. Although I can't imagine it was given a wide release. I think this was more of a director-DVD, director-video-on-demand kind of a movie.
Because also, a lot of those production houses are pretty small.
Mm.
And, I don't know, it just feels nice and little and intimate, too. We only have a handful of characters that we even actually see.
Yeah.
And I compare it a lot to Absentia.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Not only
actually
in terms of tone, but in terms of how they use what they've got. Because I imagine if the budget, if we can't find from a cursory look what the budget is, it might not actually be anywhere online. It might be so small that it wasn't worth, you know, mentioning.
And it is always interesting to see talented filmmakers understand what their budget is and be able to film and use cinematography in really interesting ways to make it seem like a more expensive product. Because this is shot really well. And as you said, Lawson, it's those scenes where it's just someone talking on a phone, where we get all of these really interesting shots from different parts of the room, different coverage of conversation. Because it's not like we're cutting in between the two people. We don't see Rosa or Rose till the end of the movie.
Yeah, and barely.
And even then, barely. So we're really just watching Rochelle's reactions to things, her acting. And
that's a
good job at covering it.
That's a pretty effective component too, that they really do start to layer in the idea of whether Rose is actually going to be a threat in the present day quite well. Like,
because she was supposed to be dead.
Yes, but is not anymore, now that the timeline has been changed with her killing her boyfriend way back in the day. But
now she's going to be a crazy, murderous old lady.
Yeah.
We've spoken about this before on the podcast. We love our geriatric slashes.
But you get those silhouetted shots of what is clearly at the end, is clearly her watching and waiting for the moment, because we find out at the end of the story that she's sort of decided that, you know, young Mary is not going to understand why this is happening to her, why she's being punished. So she wants to go and wait it out, basically, and go to Mary in the present day. So she's
this attack happening on two fronts.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got her trying to break into Mary's apartment, and then, you know, Mary hiding in the bathroom in the present day, and then Mary's on the phone with her younger self as she's being held captive by Rose in 1979. And it just is this sort of frenzied thing where, you know, in the end, what she's got to do is convince her younger self to, I don't know, stand up for herself, I suppose. Is that the message that the movie is trying to
offer? More, you know, she was in mortal danger.
Yeah. I mean,
stab the old woman.
I keep trying to come up with a way to apply the reading of the finale, to apply the events of the finale to the reading that I have of the movie's messaging on abuse and survivors of abuse. And because my problem is I can't get it to fit comfortably.
Yeah. I think that part of that comes down to the concept that we're given here, that very, very obviously you can look at the concept and go, hey, that's a very clean vehicle to discuss, like, trauma and discuss all of those sorts of things, but you then come up to the difficulty of resolution.
Well, the difficulty of Rose being another abuse victim who then turns into an insane abuser.
Yeah.
I do wonder, like, if it was Bobby instead of Rose, like, I don't know, because the second I say that, I start to think, oh, but then it's just this really nasty story about this woman being, you know, stalked by an abusive husband in the present day and an abusive lunatic in 1979. Because everything that follows on from that, Rose ending up being the one in the wall in the pantry and, you know, all of that stuff, it just becomes really nasty in a way that even this version of the movie isn't. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know if the movie would have had the sense to pull that off.
Yeah. Look, I think that the movie clearly has intent. The filmmaker clearly is attempting to make a feminist film. It's just that the ending in particular muddies that water somewhat. Obviously, we do get our sort of a Yas Queen moment where she kills Steven. Because let's face it, no one's going to miss that prick. But also, she goes nuts and walks him up in the apartment, humming her little song. I think that...
And worse than that, is not driven nuts by the supernatural events of the film, but by the man, you know, by the just plain... I say plain, that sounds awful, it's not what I mean, but just, you know, the non-supernatural domestic abuse that she is suffering.
Yeah.
That's the thing that, in this movie's terms, breaks her. That's troubling to me.
I think that this is yet another horror movie we'd like to, like, shave the last 30 seconds out of. Why does this keep happening this year?
I don't know if it's... I think it's just everyone wants that Halloween last 30 seconds where Michael Myers isn't on the ground anymore. Everyone wants that last little, like, ooh, thing that the audience can...
I know exactly what it is. People are chasing the end of Friday the 13th.
Yeah, like, it's that one last scare thing, you know, or that one last, like, little twist that to end with true finality is, in the parlance of horror, or, you know, this particular era of horror, you know, is a missed opportunity.
Yeah, and I don't know. For me, I get what the ending's doing. Like, I get it. I understand it. But it muddies its message by doing so. And obviously, it's a very complex message to discuss. We've spoken about this multiple times on multiple horror movies that we've looked at in the past. Horror movies that are attempting to have that feminist message. But again, it's... And I'm not saying that a man can't do a feminist project. But there is that distance that men have. Like, there's a distance that we as men have to that sort of concept. Obviously, men can still be abused in multiple different situations and can still become victims. It's just that what the movie is framing is not a male experience, not this specific one.
Mm.
And there might be a sort of like difficulty present there.
I don't know about that, because it really does come down to mechanics. It comes down to the final way of the plot being constructed. It's not that it is right-minded, but then has an odd...
It gives us
like...
too much of an answer at the end. It's trying to do the horror movie thing, trying to do the cliche, where if it cut when she looked at Stephen, then that's leaving it open to interpretation what happens next.
Yeah.
And that's always going to be more interesting to people than...
That's true.
A concrete answer, mind the pun.
I guess
that thing really quietly.
Well, it's apparently been done at least 3 times before. So,
how did the neighbors not notice?
She scars this little girl, right?
Yeah,
and then just lets her go, and then gets her again later on.
Okay, again, so she kills
George.
Okay, so she would kill
Bobby, George, then
Bobby.
John.
Yeah, so first she kills Bobby. By this point, she hasn't killed George yet.
No.
So she's already bricked the thing up. So what I'm getting from that is she's had to take the bricks away, put George in there, brick it back up, and then take the bricks away, put John in there as a child.
I don't know, George and Johnny kind of happens in quick succession.
Not really. Not if you're looking at sort of the time dilation effect.
I know. She straight up is the one that she is on the phone and tells John, make sure she knows I figured out who the rat is. And she says in that same conversation, John so-and-so, you know, I know you, your parents own that shop. Like, we know from that, in retrospect, decision. So
we know that that's going to happen, but at the same time, she's torn down and bricked that wall back up 3 separate times by this point, and is going and killing people without anyone being being none the wiser.
Look,
she
like as
Lawson
said,
Mary as a child, and Mary hasn't told her mother about it. This woman is still.
I think her mother knows, John. Like I think.
Yeah.
Well, knows that she's been burned, but might not know that it's this crazy old woman who's done that, or 41-year-old
at this
point.
Even then, she's
not
old,
But, again, it's like, she's doing crimes willy-nilly, like, no one could possibly give a shit to try to
find out. She cut off her own fingers, too.
She cut off her own fucking finger!
She called the shit out of that bluff.
Oh, yeah, she called the bluff, but I would have bluffed back and said, you didn't have a finger the first time I spoke to you, so...
Thought it wasn't relevant. But like, here's the other thing, too. That sort of construction cannot be in the tenancy agreement. Like, she's breaking her lease here, and that ain't good.
Yes, she's committing heinous crimes, including the murder of a child, but she's breaking her lease as well.
Mary is renting, but Rose might own outright.
Ah, that's true.
That's a good point, I guess.
Like, she's spending a good deal of money on bricks and cement, too. Like, that's not easy to cart up. Like, are we thinking she's, like, ground level? Because I don't know if that place is, like, high scale enough to even have a lift.
I'm thinking mainly stairs.
Like, Louise, she's carting that shit up on the stairs.
It's interesting to look at Luis Guzman's performance in retrospect with the whole arc of the movie. Like, that bit where he sort of, like, almost kind of reluctantly, like, chivalry gets the best of him. Do you need help carrying that inside? Because he doesn't want to be in the apartment. He turns down the coffee. We find out later on because he, last time he was in that apartment, was finding her dead body, strangled. Yeah. She strangled herself, hung herself with the phone cord.
Tensely strong.
That's a strong phone cord.
Like, to the point where, hey, Telstra, put the person who made that phone cord on a payroll. Not that we use phone cords anymore.
Telstra is the phone company. They don't, like, make the phones.
I know.
But, like, that's sort of through all of that. But then after Rose has changed things in the past and killed her boyfriend, then the whole idea of Luis Guzman's performance becomes completely different. Because it is kind of a suspicious thing. Like, yeah, that woman freaked me out. Like, I'm not...
She got a bad vibe.
Yeah. She kept bricking up the walls. knocking them down again.
Her going on... All night.
No one was brave enough to go ask her about it because she was a bit of a freak. So,
and, like, you really got to question the effectiveness of the Puerto Rican police in the 70s. If, like, literally the guys in her building disappears, they would be interviewing everyone in that building, and she's just got like a nice, freshly mortared pantry wall.
What is this? Like, they can't possibly know what I've done, but I hear the beating of his hideous heart. But, like, the other thing is, the guy who owns the building, useless.
Yeah, who even owns it?
Like, she calls the dude on the phone to fix the...
That might not even be the owner, though. That just might be the caretaker.
Yeah. But, like, how... I'm not surprised she got away with it. Let's be real. There is basically no oversight in that building.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Luis Guzman is doing the gardening. Like, there is no... Yeah. The caretaker's not even taking care of that.
I was happy to see that George seemed to be a pretty stand-up bloke.
Yeah.
I was a good dude. I was dreading a reveal that it was just a bunch of dudes in cahoots.
Well,
Dudes in cahoots, that's a band name.
I mean, it's a strong choice that the movie makes in killing off both George and John that they then don't reverse, because it's, you know, I was kind of waiting for the reveal that John is still alive now, because now that Mary got her childhood self to kill John, to kill Rose, that John hadn't been murdered yet, was just her captive at that point in 79, and that her standing up to Rose had restored his life in the present day. But no, that's not what kind of movie this is.
No, it's far nastier. It's both timelines running concurrently, almost.
Yeah.
Like, and...
The moment he disappears is that he died.
Yeah.
And they make... They don't make a big deal out of it either. Like, they don't have a big, like, final scene where you're like, oh, well, John's dead meat because he just had this big sort of, like, cliche final scene. It's just like, no, I'll see you later. And then later on a phone call, I'll meet you later.
Yeah.
And then...
You just get a feeling where it's like, well, see you, John.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
But that's the other thing, too. The mechanics all track.
Mm.
The mechanics of how the phone works, how the time works, that all stays really, really consistent, but they never tell us how or why.
Well, I think the only thing you can draw, and I was arguing that it's science fiction, but now that I think about it, I think you might be right. It's more supernatural, Harley, that... Like,
she hangs herself with the phone.
She hangs herself with the phone cord, and the phone is the connection back to her through time.
And that's the interesting thing, because there are theories, and it's a thing that we've seen in every Mike Flanagan ghost story that he's ever done, that time is weird for ghosts, that they don't just exist on the same arrow-only-moves-forward way that we do, that it's more slippery than that, that it's more... tenuous a grasp on time itself. And I think that's so interesting. It's, again, it's that kind of horror or that kind of quote-unquote sci-fi that you get in Twilight Zone, even Twin Peaks, that kind of just bizarre things that shouldn't happen but just happen anyway. But Absentia is kind of like that. It's just a thing that is happening that doesn't have a proper explanation, and people are just left to it.
But again, the thing is, the apartment's not haunted.
No.
It's not a ghost. There is connection that has been made there somehow, and I wouldn't be surprised if she's not the first person that's been called.
Yeah.
In that apartment.
And I wouldn't doubt it.
Like, connected to Rose, you mean?
Well,
or connected
else? I wouldn't be surprised if the people who were in that apartment beforehand started getting those calls
from Rose.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. And I don't know, this...
It just never went this far.
Yeah, it just never went this far. Because she was in a... Mary was in an incredibly vulnerable spot. Alone, in a new place, and seeking connection, even though she's very wary of being connected to anybody. Perhaps when there's a couple living there, there's less stuff for Mary to latch onto, let's say. But they still don't explain how it's happening, which is still really, really cool to me. It keeps it in that between space, between science fiction and supernatural horror. But at the end of the day, it still feels haunted. That tone is still present throughout the entire thing. The appearances of Stephen in the apartment. At one point, I thought that Stephen will have killed himself and is appearing as a ghost in that apartment. Mm. I've just watched too many horror movies, and that's immediately what came to mind. But it's also how the filmmaker frames his shots, the color grade that's used on the film. It feels very harsh.
Yeah.
Very isolating, in a way that area might not look. And I don't know, it just, tonally, it works incredibly well as a visual experience, because it arrests the attention.
All right, I feel we're reaching the end of our conversation here, unless there's anything else that you two would like to add.
No, I'm good.
In that case, why don't we now move on to our segment of recasting this movie for the Muppet parody version. Which Muppet would you recast in which role for the Muppet The Caller? I suppose that...
Mary stays human.
Mary stays human, yes. Miss Piggy becomes Rose, definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Kermit is John.
Yep. Fozzie for the Luis Guzman character.
Yeah, I can see that.
I also kind of like the idea of keeping him. Keeping Luis Guzman.
Luis Guzman...
I like the idea
of... bit of a fuzziness to him.
I like the idea of when Mary knocks down the wall at the end, instead of skeletons, it's like these moth-eaten old puppets, like torn with felt coming out of them. And
yeah. Okay.
That's pretty much everyone, though. No, the...
Stephen.
Yeah, Stephen.
It's... Oh my god, this one's going to be incredibly hard to pick.
Is it even appropriate to put a Muppet in that role?
I don't know.
Let's just stay away from that and move on.
Rolf is the dog.
Yeah, I suppose so. Like, that just gets into a weird, like, Mickey and Mickey Mouse and Goofy with Pluto there as well. Like, at what point is the Muppet sentient or not?
Don't fucking even think about it. Gosh.
Well, now why don't we move on to say who our MVP is for this movie, what our favourite scene or sequence is, and of course, who we would recast with this podcast, patron saint, character actor John Lithgow.
Knock, knock, who's there? Me!
I will start us off and I will say that my MVP for this movie is Rachelle Lefevre, because I think that she is really anchoring the movie from beginning to end. Obviously, Lorna Ray was on the phone with her a lot, but for a lot, she's the only person on screen. She's having to be alone on a set, making a phone call somehow dynamic, and she does it. And in addition to all of that, she also brings real emotional weight, emotional stakes to the story of her character and the situation that she's in. She sells the romance with Stephen Moyer's character. She sells the trauma and the nastiness of those later scenes. And I think that this is really a movie that is built on her performance as its foundation. So I'm going to go with her. In terms of my favorite scene or sequence, I am going to go with what I think is the nastiest scene in the movie, which is when she finally knocks down the wall and finds the bodies in there, including the child body of John, who she just saw this morning. So that's just a really, like, it's a horrific moment. It's a horrific scene. It's a real payoff of just how dangerous Rose is and just how much damage she can do, even separated out from Mary across 30 years of distance. And the performance of Lefebvre in that moment is just really, really strong. So I'm going with that. In terms of who I would recast with this podcast's patron saint character, John Lithgow, I'm going with the character of George. I think that he would be a very strong next-door neighbor type, sort of very that warmth, that kindness that Lithgow can bring. That would just make it all the worse when he disappears so suddenly. But he also, you could buy him as a guy who, you know, has that knowledge of the place and has been around for a long time, and he can bring that history, that exposition that is necessary, in a way.
Real
that,
harbinger energy.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to go with him.
So for me, I will have to say that my MVP is Lefebvre. She is phenomenal here, and she's doing a lot of it by herself, making those scenes dynamic. And that is incredibly important, because if it was just the static shot of her on the phone, that'd be boring as batshit. And I would not have been able to get through the movie if that were the case. Obviously got to give credit to who she's on the phone with. Incredible, incredible stuff on the phone. But Lefebvre is doing a lot more. And obviously that's by virtue of appearing on the screen. But she nails every bit of the movie. And one of the really nice things about the performance is Mary's not fragile. Mary is incredibly resilient. She's already walked away from Stephen. She's already taken steps to cut him out of her life. And she's really, really trying. She's nowhere close to backsliding and letting him back in. She's nowhere close to that. But she still has to deal with a lot of really, really tough things. And that's a dichotomy that Lefebvre performs incredibly well. My favorite scene or sequence is a bit of a weird one. It's right after she spent the night at John's, but she has that dream, that nightmare, of walking down the hallway in his apartment. She sees the phone right at the end of the hall, and as she goes to reach for it, she keeps walking, but she stays in the same spot with the phone just out of reach. And it reminds me of some of the nightmares I have, and it nailed that sort of energy really, really well. But I gotta give credit to the scene where the wounds start appearing on her body as her younger self is getting quite literally scolded. It works really, really well, and the effects are very, very good. Movie's not very effects heavy. It only has one real scene where those sorts of visual effects are needed, and that's it. So they had a lot of time to work on that, I would imagine. Very good practical filmmaking here. Who I'd recast with John Lithgow? It's George. Not only because he would be very well suited to that particular role, that sort of harbinger character who tells the lead what's been going on. There's always one of those in any, I guess, haunted house movies or stories. And I feel like he would be a very warm presence. And love Luis Guzman in this. I think he's a really fun actor in a lot of projects. But I don't want to give Lithgow any of the other roles, because I don't think he works for John and doesn't work for Stephen. And that's really about it. So, John, what about you?
Yeah, I have to give it to Navarre, because she does such a good job at holding the space.
Who's Navarre?
Oh, I've gotten confused. What's the name of the woman who plays Mary?
Lefebvre,
sorry. Michelle Lefebvre, I have to give major props to. She's my MVP for this. Because she's holding the space on her own. She's holding the camera on her own. And while I love the vocal performance of Rose, it is really Lefebvre who is holding the attention of the audience. In particular, the scene that Holly pointed out where she is being burnt in the past. It's a sort of tough thing to try and get your head around as an actor, and she does it fantastically. And everything she does, you just see the realness there. So I think her performance is particularly strong, and it just makes me sad that she was not asked back to play Victoria in those later, you know, Twilight films, because that character really does get more to do later on. For my favorite scene or sequence, I agree with Lawson. It's the scene where Mary tears that wall down and sees the bodies, because it's, again, it's this sort of mind-twisting thing of, holy shit, she's killed them in the past, and they were here yesterday. She killed them 30 years ago, but they were here yesterday, kind of.
But they also weren't.
But they also weren't. I'm the only person who can remember them. It's such a nasty twist. It's such an interesting twist. And it ties all back into the abuse themes in this film. And I think that's a really strong scene. Brilliantly acted, but brilliantly acted by Lefebvre. And who I would get John Lithgow as, I think George is the best pick for him because he can have that weathered look to him. He looks like he would have been around when Rose was in that apartment. And he can have that Harbinger energy, as Harley said. Plus, I think he'd like gardening. I don't know him, but he seems like someone who likes flowers. So, give him the daisy chain.
Right. So, now we are going to put it to a vote, whether or not we are pro the Caller podcast or not. Lawson, why don't you cast your vote first?
I'm voting no. I really do like this movie. I think it's very clever, and it works quite well as this feature-length Twilight Zone episode. I mean, I've said before how much I enjoy smaller movies, movies off the beaten track, and how much I want to do more of them on this podcast as deep dives. But really, the ending is what does it in for me. I can't quite get past where the messaging of the movie ultimately seems to leave it. I don't think it was intentional, but I think it does muddy what was otherwise a story that I felt played its hand very well.
Mm. I agree with you, Lawson. I was so close to that pro vote, but the last 30 seconds, man. I don't know why it keeps happening to us. Of course, in The Perfect Host, it was lost, I don't know, third. But here, the movie's firing on all cylinders. I really like how clever it is. I like what it's saying, and the performances are all fantastic. The film is really, really great. That last 30 seconds. I can't say that it corrupts the rest of it, because it doesn't, but I also can't remove it from the movie, you know? I can't do that. I need to look at what's actually there, and I can't think about what I prefer it to be when I rate it. So, it's close, but no cigar. It's going to be a no for me.
And it's a no for me, because I agree with both of you that the ending doesn't really gel with what the rest of the film is saying, and at the end of the day, the ending is what's going to stick in a person's mind. It's our last chance to have a conversation with the film on its own terms. So I can't necessarily get over that line either, because it's very strong up until that point, and it doesn't corrupt the rest of the film in the way that some endings have in the past, but it just, it makes things a little muddy. It twists things in a way that doesn't feel like it works. So it's a no from me.
So there you have it. We are not a pro The Caller podcast.
Aww.
So if you would like to reach us, you can find us at each of our blogs. You can find us at Exit Through the Candy Counter for John and myself on the Bright Side. You can also reach us through our Twitter, which is the best place to give us episode-specific feedback and movie recommendations. What do you think about The Caller? I'd actually like to track down that episode that was based on off that old TV show.
And there
show.
Is actually a remake on Netflix called The Call. It is set in South Korea.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind checking that out at some point. But what is your favorite telephone-based horror-slash-thriller movie? Because I know that there are shitloads of movies called The Caller, or some variation thereof. What is your favorite one of those, too?
The Black Phone.
Yeah, kind of uses a similar thing. But you can also like, rate, comment, share, and subscribe on your podcast app of choice. Just keep in mind, on certain podcast apps, you will be commenting on the show on the whole, and on others on specific episodes. if you want one of the services that has the comments be on the show on the whole, just cite which episode you're referring to in your comment so we can get back to you about that and fix any mistake. Well, address anything that needs to be addressed at any point. We'll also take recommendations for movies there. Nothing over 3 hours, please. I got a lot of shit to do. But please do like, rate, comment, share, and subscribe. I'm getting the strong feeling that in terms of time travel, I have described how the information seeps into my head in the modern day as I'm delivering it and writing it down in the past. It has the same sort of vibe to it. I don't know if I can change anything in the past right now, but I have vague recollections of things. It is a very complex state of mind to be in. Time not being as solid as one once thought it was, I still have very little answers from the machines about this.
So Lawson, what have we got cooking for next week?
Well, next week we will be doing a very different type of movie. We are recording this episode a few days after the death of Michael Gambon, and completely unintended. I had already made the decision to do this movie before that news, that unfortunate news came out, but completely unintended. We will be doing a movie with Michael Gambon in it, but another fairly, I would say, small movie that you guys might not have heard of. It is a 2011 BBC TV movie starring Bill Nighy called Page 8. It is an espionage, a spy thriller. And I would just say also that it is incredibly dialogue heavy and really, really important dialogue that you've got to pay close attention to. So be warned, listeners. If you would like to follow along at home, you can find it available for purchase or rental on the YouTube, Apple, and Amazon stores in Australia.
Yep, so join us next week for when we discuss
Page 8.
Page 8. I'm sure this will be one of those I have the subtitles on for, just so I don't miss anything. So join us next week for that. Until then, I have been Holly Lewis.
I've been Lawson Keeney.
And I have been and will continue to be Jean Lewis.
Thank you.